this is a session on loneliness as a religious issue. And I want to say a little bit about that before I begin, or as I begin. The things that I'm going to share with you today grew out of, a request that came to me a couple of years ago from the editor of a magazine by the name of Entree, which is a, if some of you are familiar with Lutheran Campus Ministry, I'm a Lutheran Campus pastor, and part of our national system is a magazine that used to be called The Circle. Does anybody remember The Circle here? I guess nobody does. Well, it changed its name, which doesn't make any difference to you, to Entree. And the editor is a man named Kurt Reichert, and naturally he likes to get his articles in on time, and he had requested for one of the issues of the magazine an article on loneliness, because that's an issue that, as you might imagine, homesickness, loneliness is an issue that campus pastors sometimes face as they're talking with students who are perhaps away from home for the first time for an extended period of time. Anyway, the guy who he asked to write that article backed out on him, not very, very far from the deadline, and he called me up and asked me if I would write an article about loneliness. Well, I had never thought much about it, but I had some time, and I figured I'd be able to use this against him later on. I'd do this favor for him, and then I could use that for leverage someday, and so I'm always looking for opportunities like that. And so what I'm going to share with you is an article that he had requested for, and it wasn't really, the article itself was more for people who are in campus ministry or who are in ministries who deal with people who are lonely rather than for lonely people themselves. So it takes that kind of a slant. It's talking to people who deal with lonely people, but there's kind of an ironic twist to it that you'll catch as we go along. So that's what this is all about. And as I got into it and started to read about it and started to think about what my own experiences with loneliness were and what my experiences were with the people who I had talked to who were lonely, we had shared that together, I realized that it wasn't the kind of thing that you, it was something that all of us share as human beings. And that's kind of the basis of what I want to talk about. And this article basically took off I sort of created a composite of a couple of people that I had talked to, and it starts off by referring to a woman, and I can tell you about her after we get done, if you're interested. But she was a woman who came into my office a couple of years ago, and by any conventional set of criteria, there was no reason why she should have been there. She was a graduate student. She was a recent graduate in the American Studies program. And she was really somebody who had done it all. She was somebody who studied in Europe and South America, and she spent her summers on archaeological digs and traveling in Europe, and she'd been mountain climbing in Peru, and she'd skied and, you know, all over the world, and she'd learned about three languages, and so she was just kind of a prototype of a very successful, well-to-do, popular, you know, healthy, physically attractive, intelligent person. And at the time that she came in to see me, it was she was just finishing up her work at Portland State, and she was in the midst of applying to law schools. And it wasn't like she was just trying to get into any law school that would take her, but she was going for all the best law schools. And it wasn't a question of whether they were going to let her in or not. It was a question of who was going to give her the best financial aid package. So, I mean, this was a very successful person by any conventional set of criteria. And whenever I saw her on campus, she was either in the middle of a real intense conversation with someone, or she was rushing between appointments. You know, she was somebody that kept an appointment book, which most students, frankly, don't do. I have to say that. So of all the people I knew, I'd say to myself, there's somebody who has it together. You know, here was somebody that if you looked at her and talked with her, you'd say, you know, this person has it together. But yet here she was sitting in my office, and she was trying to come to terms. And as we talked, it was kind of like this vast emptiness. And she'd never really slowed down in her life long enough to pay much attention to it. Now, through a series of events in her life, she was forced to face the fact. And she was sitting there with tears running down her cheeks, and she looked at me with this kind of look of anger and pain, and she just, I remember her saying through clenched teeth, "Sometimes I just get so lonely and nobody will listen to me and nobody will believe me." And I think she was hurt by a combination of the fact that she was lonely, but also the fact that anytime she tried to tell anybody that she was feeling lonely, they would never believe her. Because, you know, I had a hard time believing her, because I looked at her life and I said, this person can't be lonely. And yet that was the case. Loneliness, isolation, despair, alienation, you know, we have all sorts of names for it. My wife says that there are people who die from loneliness, but it just never shows up on the death certificate. You know, there's something else that they die from technically, but in actuality, it's loneliness. People just get lonely and die. Okay, thank you for sharing that. I think that's another age segment. I don't think that loneliness is restricted to an age segment, but I guess that corroborates what I'm going to try to say here. If you talk to like mental health professionals, ministers, psychotherapists, and others, they talk about loneliness as one of the, like Leo did, one of the leading mental health problems today. And if you've ever been in campus ministry, which was who I was mainly thinking about when I started working on this, you encounter it in a variety of forms. You encounter it from the freshman who is just, as I say, that away from home, maybe for the first time for any kind of extended period of time. Or you may come onto it, and again, I'm interpreting loneliness widely here, but you'll run into a graduate student who is going through some sort of a dark night of the soul, sitting and talking about suicide as not something that's unattractive, partly because of isolation and alienation. So it's something that you see in a whole variety of ways, in a whole variety of age groups, as you say. A couple of years ago, I'm at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon, and it's a commuter campus in downtown Portland, and a photographer who's a friend of mine and myself were putting together, I guess you'd call it a public relations piece. We were trying to interpret campus ministry to congregations in the Portland area, and we were using pictures to do that, slides. And so he came down a couple of weekends and shot a lot of pictures of life on campus. And then we got together and we started to put together this slideshow. And one of the things that struck us as we were looking at these slides was that the tremendous sense of alienation on this campus, and it came and isolation that came through on these pictures. It was just, and he hadn't gone out, you know, looking for pictures of that, you know, trying to take pictures of isolated, alienated type people. And yet, every time he took a picture, that you couldn't help but see that. Even pictures that showed people exchanging with one another, there was something about it, you know, it just, you would see pictures in which folks would be sitting on park benches on a very nice day, and there'd be like no interaction between anybody on the campus. And you just see a lot of people in you know, even though the campus was full of people in the springtime, there was not much interaction between anybody. And I'd say that after having been there for 4 years, if there's anything that characterizes life on that campus, and there's a few people here that have gone there, it is a sense of isolation and alienation, because it's a very easy place to get lost. Now, there's all sorts of reasons for that. I suppose part of it, you know, is the architecture. It's sort of concrete, modern. When I first got there, there were three buildings on campus that were all known to students as the Bastille. So, that'll give you some indication of what the architecture was like there. Also, just the society that we're living in today and the nature of that campus, which is a commuter campus where people drive in, take their class, and go home and really don't have much to do with it. It's kind of like the safe way of higher education. You come in and you get your quart of milk and then you go home. And there's no homecoming and there's no school fight song that I know of. It's just not a place that people do that kind of thing. Well, as I started to work on this thing, as I say, I started to get a growing conviction that loneliness is really a religious issue, or at least it has some real religious ramifications, and it raises some religious questions. And it seems to me that after I've thought about it, and we'll test this out with you and see if you think that's true too, but when we confront loneliness in one of its many forms, we're really confronting a religious question or a religious issue of really profound kinds of dimensions. When we're on to loneliness, we're on to something that's religious and it's important. Now, the person that first got me started in thinking in that direction was a colleague of mine who's named Terry Moe. He's a pastor in Portland, Oregon. And at the time, he was serving an isolated parish up on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington. Have any of you ever been up on the Olympic Peninsula? One of the things that you can say about that is there aren't a whole lot of people, and at least in the wintertime, it is a very isolated place. It's beautiful there, but it's also a very lonely place. And he was a pastor up there. And he spent a lot of time driving around, calling on parishioners by himself in his car. And he was the person that introduced me to the work of a guy named Henry Nouwen. Have any of you heard of Henry Nouwen? Henry Nouwen is he's done all sorts of things. I'm not sure what he's doing right now. At the time that I was introduced to him, he was a pastoral care professor at Harvard in the Divinity School. But anyway, Nouwen's contention was that before a person like myself or anybody that works with lonely people could even begin to comfort lonely persons, that person needed to come to terms with his own or her own sense of loneliness and isolation. And to come to terms with their own sense of loneliness and isolation and to view it not as some kind of an obstacle to be overcome, but really as a source of any kind of help that you were going to be able to offer to anybody. The article that Terry Moe wrote when he was thinking about this was called The Paradox of Loneliness, and that was the general idea, that first, if you were going to relate to somebody who was feeling lonely, you were first going to have to admit the fact that you were lonely yourself, and you were going to have to not look at that as something that you had to overcome, but something that was going to help both of you. He quoted Henry Nouwen, who says, "The more I think about loneliness, the more I think that the wound of loneliness is like the Grand Canyon, a deep incision in the surface of our existence, which has become an inexhaustible source of beauty and self-understanding." Which gives you some indication of why he talked about it as the paradox of loneliness, because he talks about it as a wound, but then he compares it to the Grand Canyon, which is this beautiful wound in the surface of the earth. Now one would say that the Christian way of life doesn't really take away our loneliness. What it does is it protects it and cherishes it as a precious gift. So you can see that he's into paradox here now. Now, the woman who was sitting in my office was probably not ready to hear that. You know, she came in and telling me she was so lonely and she was so frustrated because nobody would listen to her. And, you know, I suppose I could have pulled out that quote from Henry Nouwen you know, if she didn't throw something at me, she certainly would have walked out feeling frustrated because she wasn't ready to hear about her loneliness as a deep wound, you know, that was inexhaustible beauty and all that. At that point in her life, she was very angry and rightfully so, and she needed to come to terms with that. And yet part of the reason for her anger and my surprise at talking with her about that particular set of feelings that she had and my reluctance to even deal with it was I was reluctant at the point she came into my office to even talk about the fact that I had some cavernous empty spaces in my own life as well. And until I really came to face that, I wasn't going to be much use to her. One of the things that we have a tendency to do, I think, and it's in our society, but I think it's true in the church as well, when we're facing pain and when we're facing people with pain, we have a tendency to want to deny pain or at least overcome it. And Nouwen is saying that until we're able to see our own loneliness not as some kind of a liability or a flaw to be covered over, but rather as a source of healing and power, we're not really going to be able to help lonely people. So, because what it does is it puts us in the same situation that they're in. And in all of Nouwen's work, that's one of the things that he's really big on. You're not going to be able to help people if you think of yourself as the healthy person and they as being a person with a problem, but you have to see some kind of a joint humanity. So when you're dealing with lonely people, the thing that you first have to come to terms with is the fact that you're a lonely person too. Okay. So, like most religious truth, this one is subtle and it's paradoxical. And it's really rooted, I think, in the most profound of paradoxes, what we call the theology of the cross that the Apostle Paul talks about. He says, you know, the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength, and the whole paradox that's associated with that. You know, how do you help somebody with a problem who admit that you've got the same problem yourself? And out of that, you're able to relate to them. Now, most of us, and I was thinking about pastors when I said this, but it's probably true for most of it. We're, you know, all of us as pastors use that kind of rhetoric in the pulpit. You know, we talk about that when we preach, and we talk about the theology of the cross. But a lot of us, I guess, don't use that very much when we think about counseling with people, with students. It hits us, I think, too close to where we live. You know, the theology of the cross is nice for when you're in church, but when you're in a counseling situation, we kind of tend to drop it, I guess. And like most paradoxes, I guess I need to say, this one, too, is liable to distortion and not a small amount of abuse. You know, truth as paradox is always susceptible to distortion because you can emphasize one part of the paradox at the expense of the rest, and if you split the paradox, it doesn't make any sense. And here's another one. If you employ that idea of the theology of the cross or you know, admitting you're lonely, without any sensitivity, you know, it can sound just like the pious kinds of stuff that we tell people, you know, oh, you'll get over it. You know, have you ever had anybody tell you that? You know, take a walk around the block or, you know, go to a party, you know, you'll get over it. I think that's part of the problem, that we employ those paradoxes without sensitivity. The other part, I think, is that, especially for pastors, we think of ourselves sometimes as we have a model of ourselves as healers, and we don't use a religious kind of a model, we use sort of a medical model. There's a guy by the name of Regis Duffy, who's a Roman Catholic, who writes about pastoral care, and he says the model that we employ is medicus, which means we think of ourselves in sort of the caricature of a doctor. And the caricature is that when somebody comes to us, we think of a healer, we think of somebody who takes the pain away. Okay, that's what a medicus does. When somebody comes with a problem, they give you something to take the pain away. And not as somebody that helps us to look at that pain and see what's going on there. Okay. Now, I don't think good doctors take away all the pain necessarily all the time before they can find out what's wrong either, but we sometimes have that notion about that. So that's why I say it's a caricature. Right, that's our caricature of them, and they're different from that. But so we've got a bad notion, a false notion, I guess, not necessarily bad, a false notion of who we are because we model it on a false notion of what doctors are, and that is as somebody that just takes pain away. Now, if you think about somebody, okay, let's be real literal about this. Let's say somebody that's a healer or somebody that helps you enter into the pain. That when you first talk about that, it sounds very sadistic, especially in our culture. And yet, for Christians, it really lies at the heart of our theology. And one of the distinctions that you have to make here, I think, is the difference between well-being and salvation. Okay, think about those two ideas. Salvation on the one hand and well-being. Now, most of us are used to thinking about them as not being very necessarily, you know, antithetical to one another, you know. Salvation is well-being, only more of it and forever. It never stops. But this is an idea that I picked up in a real strange source. It was by a guy by the name of Adolf, get this now, Guggenbuehl Craig, who was a therapist who wrote a book called, and the title is even better, it's called Marriage Dead or Alive, which is a very interesting book. But he makes a distinction between well-being and salvation. And he's a Jungian. And if you know anything about Jungians, this will start to make a little bit of sense to you. Well-being, he says, has to do with the avoidance of unpleasant tensions and the striving for a state of comfort and relaxation. That's what he's meaning by well-being. Happiness and physical as well as psychological health are associated with well-being. Pain and tension, and especially loneliness, are not associated with well-being. Part of what we do, I think, as pastoral counselors is to help people to achieve some kind of a sense of well-being in their life. And there's nothing wrong with well-being. You know, you think about the biblical concept of shalom, you know, the peace of God, and it's all loaded up with well-being. You know, the lion and the lamb lay down and everybody's got enough to eat and there's no conflict. You know, that's well-being. Okay, but he says there's something else, and that's not the same thing for him as salvation. He says there's all kinds of philosophies and religions and all sorts of ways to salvation. He's not particularly a Christian. But he says one of the things that all theologies of salvation have in common is a confrontation with suffering and death. and loneliness. So instead of avoiding that, in most religious ways of salvation, the thing that you have to do is not avoid suffering and death and loneliness, but you have to confront them. Okay, that's salvation has to do with wrestling with the God, with God and the devil and the world and death, and with your sense of loneliness, and sometimes with the absence of God, the fact that God isn't there. Salvation means facing and embracing the shadow of our existence, rather than trying to hide from it. Though a sense of well-being is essential to a happy life, it is not the same thing as salvation. And it provides no substitute for salvation either. So part of our task as healers is to includes helping people to achieve some kind of a sense of well-being in their lives, but another part includes supporting people on their journey of salvation. When you think about what a pastor does, it's, you know, helping people to move along on the journey of salvation, and not just well-being. So the confrontation and the embrace of loneliness and emptiness is really an essential part of that journey. The person who asks, why am I so lonely, is really asking us a religious question, because they're getting at something in life, you know, that we kind of skirt around sometimes, but that whole notion of the absence of God, you know, the emptiness, the sense that we sometimes have that nobody's there, especially God. When I first read that, I was kind of put off by it, but I think he's really on to something there. I think about, for instance, Jesus' last words on the cross, or next to last words on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? You know, now there's a statement of loneliness that is as profound as any you'll ever see. You know, Jesus, the Son of God himself, is having to confront this absence of God, this loneliness. And I think in a small way, when we're confronting our own loneliness, we're facing up to the same thing that Jesus was in a large way on the cross. So there's, and the cross is the way of salvation. Okay. Through the valley of the shadow for Jesus and for us lays the path of salvation. So if we're concerned not just with the well-being of people that we're talking to and who come to us looking for help and for healing, but if we're also concerned with their salvation, we need to confront and embrace the shadow of our own loneliness. Instead of trying to take loneliness away, we need to spend some time talking about that, finding out what that's all about. And we need to remember the claim of the gospel, I think, that the key to our well-being, as well as our salvation, lies in that embrace. Because in the gospel, finally, well-being and salvation end up being the same thing. I mean, they're not always the same thing, but they end up joining one another. The claim of the gospel is that also, in addition, the claim of the gospel is that salvation isn't just something that happens to one person. It's something that happens to all of us as a community. There's a communal dimension to salvation which can't be ignored, and that's where I think it hooks up with loneliness. Matthew Fox quotes a German mystic by the name of Mechthild of Magdeburg, who is a medieval mystic, and she writes in one of her journals, she says, "When I can no longer bear my loneliness, I take it to my friends, for I must share it with all the friends of God. Do you suffer? So do I." Okay, she admits her suffering and she asks her friends, "Do you suffer from loneliness as well?" "No." "So do I." And that gives them a sense of commonality. At the heart of the Christian proclamation is not only the cross, however, you know, that's not the only thing, but there's also this community that forms or is formed around the cross and the resurrection. If salvation has to do with loneliness and embracing the cross, it also has to do, that's not the only thing that salvation has to do with, because it also has to do with hospitality and community and people coming together and sharing their brokenness and their loneliness with one another so that they can begin dealing with it. Drawing those folks, us folks, into some kind of a community with one another. Nouwen says this about that. He says, "Ministry is a very confronting service. It does not allow people to live with illusions of immortality and wholeness. It keeps reminding others that they are mortal and broken. But also, with the recognition of this, that is the fact that we're mortal and broken and lonely, that's where liberation starts," says Nouwen. He says, "No minister can save anyone. Literally, a minister can't save you. One can only offer oneself as a guide to fearful people. And yet, paradoxically, it is precisely in this guidance that the first signs of hope become visible. This is so because a shared pain is no longer paralyzing but mobilizing when understood as a way to liberation. When we become aware that we do not have to escape our pains, but that we can mobilize them into a common search for life, those very pains are transformed from expressions of despair into signs of hope. Through this common search, hospitality becomes community. Hospitality becomes community as it creates a unity based on a shared confession of our basic brokenness and a shared hope. The way you get through this embrace with loneliness, now one would say, is to be with other people who are also not afraid to embrace their loneliness as well, to admit the fact that they've got things in their life that aren't right. And that's the community that forms, the Christian community. And that's the pathway to salvation, he would say. There's no real answer to that question, you know, why am I so lonely? I mean, there's probably all sorts of answers to it, but ultimately I would say there's no answer to that question, just like there really isn't an answer to the other religious question that we sometimes ask ourselves, which is, you know, why do I suffer? Herbert Anderson and Kenneth Mitchell are two pastoral counselors, and you know, they put it this way: to be human is to suffer. Freedom from suffering is blindness. If you don't suffer anymore, you're really not alive anymore. It's part of what we are as human beings. So they say the principal question is not why we suffer, but instead, who suffers with us? And they say, if that is so, and if Henry Nouwen is correct in his assessment of what it is that makes for community, remember, he's saying community is made up of people who are willing to admit that they suffer and they're lonely. It seems to me then the place at which our confrontation with loneliness ultimately leads, you know, in this community, is to the mystery of the Eucharist, in which we say that the community and the cross join. And the community that gathers around the word proclaimed and the bread broken and shared and wine poured out and drunk lies that mysterious source where well-being, that is, we're fed, we're with other people, we're happy, and our salvation, which we also say comes to us through that meal, those things come together, finally. Well-being and salvation join each other in that meal. Somewhere there is the source of both our well-being and our salvation, and we would say that's God. You know, that God is the one that finally helps us through this. There's a psalm. It's one of my favorite psalms. Maybe you know it, the 139th psalm, that talks about the psalmist is, I think, confronting loneliness at that point. And I want to share part of it. It's the translation from LBW. In this case, I think it gets at some stuff. He's talking about not just loneliness, but trying to get away from God. And he says, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I climb up to heaven, you are there. If I make the grave my bed, you are there also. If I say, surely the darkness will cover me, and the light around me turn to night. Darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light to you are both alike." And I think the psalmist is getting something, at something there. And what I think he or she or whoever wrote this is getting at is that part of our experience of God is the absence of God, and yet what the psalmist is talking about is that even in the absence of God, God is still there. And again, it's a paradox. So, back to this woman. The woman who sat in my office that day not so very long ago was really the bearer of a gift for me. In the uncomfortable conversation that we had, and believe me, it was uncomfortable, she forced me to confront not only her loneliness, but I had to come to terms with my own loneliness as well. And I found out that I, even though I have a family and I've got lots of friends, I'm lonely sometimes. So really because of her fearlessness in the midst of her pain, I was enabled to really be honest and confront that. And it, somehow in that mutual confrontation with that shadow of loneliness, the pathway to salvation was opened up for both of us. I might say that not necessarily as a result of that conversation, but as a result of all kinds of things, she was eventually baptized at our campus ministry, and she did go off to law school, and I talked with her a couple times since then, and she still has to deal with loneliness and isolation, but I think she sees now that she was onto something, to a religious kind of issue, and that's the way we pursued that thing. I really don't remember what we talked about after that, and it really doesn't matter. Not long after that all happened, she left on another part of her journey. And one day I walked into my office and I noticed that there was a styrofoam cup down by the door, and it was full of water, and there was a magnolia blossom in it. There were some Japanese characters on the styrofoam cup. Unfortunately, I don't read Japanese, but there was a note underneath it, and the note said, "I now see that there is beauty in life." And she signed it, and she was gone. I didn't see her again after that for a couple of years. That was kind of how that story came to an end. It was kind of interesting because 6 months before that, she'd been sitting in my office talking about, suicide and all sorts of things because she was confronting this despair. I don't think that her despair, she's still going to have a sense of despair as we all do, but I think she was able, and she helped me to be able to deal with that sense of loneliness, and rather than try to cover it over, to get at it and look at it a little bit. So, anyway, that's what I wanted to say about loneliness, and I guess now what I'd like to do is find out what you want to say about loneliness, talk about it, because I think that that's something, again, that as Nalan would say, that's something we can share with each other. So let me stop there. I thought about that, I guess, afterwards. And I suppose that's true. I think sometimes, and not just for her, but for all of us, I think sometimes it's not so true at Holden Village. Life is a little less hectic for me, but you carry on this frantic pace. And then when something happens and you finally have to slow down, and you're just alone with yourself, you have to confront all sorts of things that you didn't know. I was talking to a guy the other day that likes to go out on solo backpacking trips. And I asked him, well, what's that like to do that? Because I do that once in a while, but not for any extended period of time. He said, well, the first time he went out there and actually had to live by himself for a week, he was just scared. He went through this tremendous sense of despair. He started to talk to himself and do all sorts of things, and finally ran into somebody on the trail who had been solo backpacking for years and told him that the same thing had happened to him. And then he got over that. But this was a case where he was put in a situation where he had to deal with it. His life changed like hers did. So he had to deal with himself. I think that's true. I think it's true for me as well. I just keep going to try to avoid those times. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Have you ever had the situation? What you're saying reminds me, have you ever had the situation happen where you set up, you said, okay, I'm going to clear the decks now, and, I'm going to, get the kids taken care of and stuff, and I'm just going to spend some time alone, and you spent some time alone and found out that you really didn't like it. In fact, you couldn't wait to get back together with other people because, I hate this. Yeah, I think, there's a little bit of that that's happened to me as well. The other thing is, I guess that makes me think about, sometimes there are situations in which our loneliness is voluntary. There are situations for a lot of people in which their loneliness is not voluntary. They're lonely, but they wouldn't be lonely if they didn't have, there's been a death or a divorce or some kind of a rupture in a relationship with somebody. And I wonder if people who have been in those kinds of situations or know about those kinds of situations want to, relate to this thing, because that's coming at it from a little bit different perspective in some ways. Well, that was the kind of the thing that I was trying to get at with when I was talking about the photographer, that the guy, he and I were walking around this campus in downtown Portland taking these pictures. I mean, there were crowds of people all over the place, but, you know, there wasn't much interaction. And the biggest, the thing that people consistently talk about, and I can count on it the first couple weeks of school at Portland State, it'll happen this fall again, I'm sure, is, you know, gosh, this is a lonely place. You know, well, there's 15,000 people, you know, within about a four-block radius there, so it's not like there isn't anybody around, but it is a very lonely place, and it's the phenomenon that you're talking about. There's lots of people, but, you know, there's not that kind of interchange going on with each other. You know, a city is a very lonely place, can be a very lonely place, where people experience a lot of isolation and despair. Yeah, or there's a good example, a big church congregation. You know, some people say, you know, I want a little congregation because, you know, there's too many people and I feel alone here. Okay, yeah. Yes. That can certainly exacerbate it, but I'd say that you could have all that other stuff and still have that sense, because, I mean, it's like, and I don't know how to, I don't have the right terminology to explain it, but it's like there's a part of you that is just isolated, and you know, there's something that isn't there, and I don't know, you know, and that's not a pervasive kind of thing, but it could certainly be there for people. Doing counseling with people in relationships, for instance, you know, people sense that even though they're maybe married to each other in a relationship, there sometimes can be that sense of isolation. So. Yeah, I don't know. I need to think about it some more. But yeah, this guy that I quoted in here with the strange name, Guggenbuehl Craig. You should see how you spell it. It's got about two umlauts in it. But anyway, his book *Marriage, Dead or Alive* is about that, really. You know, and he's talking about he's a Jungian, and I mean, I'm not sure I understand what Jungians understand, or I can even explain it, but one of the things he talks about is how marriage can be a way of salvation. You know, that's one of the reasons why he makes that distinction between well-being and salvation. So it may be true that you're one wife and two kids away from that. On the other hand, there's maybe some things that are going on in that relationship that actually are making you more whole than you'd be without that, too, so, according to him. Yes? Yeah.
If you listen up on Sunday morning, the pastor has never had a time for the lonely.
I'm glad that
you hang around the electronic church.
Yeah.
That comes at you from the full barrel from the TV.
Right. Right.
But there is no loneliness in this church.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all kind of misinterpreted. I hear you right. They're pretty concerned about the theology of Christ. They're all talking about the theology of Easter Sunday.
And what that does, I think, you know, unfortunately, I think what you're saying is true in a lot of ways. And what that does is it doesn't give anybody permission in the church to admit that they're lonely. Because, I mean, here I am amidst all of these happy, successful Christian people. And, gee, if there's something wrong with my life, obviously I don't fit here. And if I admit it, they're going to show me the door, you know. And what, you know, what Nouwen is saying is that the way that community is formed is not because everybody has it all together. What he's saying is that the way the community is formed is that people are admitting the fact that they've got some holes in their life, and so that draws them together. Not the fact that we're all, you know, we have our life all worked out and everything. And he's saying the willingness of people to admit that they have something in common with each other, and what they have in common is some pain and some suffering. That is what draws the community together, and that's how hospitality happens. I've never had them put it together quite that fast, but yeah, I guess. In a lot of instances like that, I'm in over my head. Okay, so I, In other words, I'm not sure that I'm capable of handling an in-depth counseling situation like that. I think when people are talking about suicide, you need to really take them seriously. And if it looks like something that, you know, is beyond my depth, I have some people that I try to do some referrals to. But yeah, I try to talk with that person and then, you know, see if we can, you know, make some kind of a plan to see somebody else or you know, somehow to get them through that. Right. My wife worked with a crisis line for a number of years, and she's had more experience handling those kinds of, you know, the phone call kind of thing than I have, you know, where you really do have to, you know, there's a way to do that the crisis counseling over the phone. And that's not one of my areas of expertise, unfortunately. I guess that sounds right to me. Our unwillingness to suffer with her, and even our unwillingness to watch somebody else suffer. And so we want to, I mean, it's too painful. Let's take it away. Let's do something that'll, because, and you know, why is it painful for me to see somebody else that's lonely? Well, part of it, I think, is what, you know, what Nouwen is getting at. It's because maybe we don't want to admit that we're lonely, too, you know. And that was the case with this, you know. In order to deal with this person who was facing this emptiness, I think the first thing I had to do was to face the fact that I didn't, you know, I had some empty spots, too. And that was painful, too. I think we don't want to suffer with, because it's not going to be just us bearing their pain. It's we're going to have to bear some of our own as well.
Okay.
Sure. All right. Yes. Do you suffer? Mechtel the Magdeburg says, you know, I suffer too. And that becomes the first step. Sure. Well, and I think of, for instance, you know, let's use an example of a support group of where people are willing to admit that they've got a problem together. You know, the oldest one that I know of, and probably one of the most successful, is Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, I'm not a professional counselor. I'm a pastor. But the people that I know that are professional counselors say that anybody that tries to go one-on-one with an alcoholic is going to get beat every time. It's not going to work. And yet, Alcoholics Anonymous, by putting together people that are suffering from the same kind of problem where they are supporting one another and dealing with it rather than denying it, are able to keep people, you know, in sobriety at amazing levels, you know, partly because of exactly what you're talking about. They can support each other. And I've had the opportunity and the privilege to go to a couple Alcoholics open meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I saw the way, you know, people confronted one another when they thought somebody wasn't dealing with what they needed to deal with. And you know, they're not, it's not like they're trying to put each other down, but they're going to make sure that, you know, the business is dealt with there, at least in the groups that I was able to see. You know, I haven't been following it long. I haven't been doing this long enough to know if I can see a trend or not. I see the kinds of groups that you're talking about, that we've all been talking about on campus, you know, starting up, and some of them work and some of them don't. I guess my feeling is that there could probably be a lot more of those kinds of support groups for people.